After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Hi, everybody. Ram Dass here and now. I am back, Raghu, and I'm with, we won't say how old a buddy, but someone very, very close to me, and we have done so much work over the years together, Rameshwar Dass. Ramesh, welcome.
I am an old buddy. We are about the same age, probably.
Okay, forget about that. I do want to say to everybody this, tell everybody this podcast is going to be centered around the release of Ram Dass's new memoir, Being Ram Dass. And Ramesh and I don't think you've been on Ram Dass here and now. Have you? Maybe. Maybe with Ram Dass, I think,
possibly,
sometime back. Yeah.
Would have been a while ago.
Yeah. We thought it would be appropriate to, just talk about how this book came together with Ramesh. And we're going to play some excerpts that are a very, very small sampling of what Ram Dass, the teachings that he represents, the life that he represents, the incarnation. But I think there'll be enough to give enough of a picture, and certainly a little bit of a picture of the book, because it's all going to be related to that. And, so happy to have you here to do that. But maybe talk a little bit, Ramesh, about what happened. Were we sitting around with Ram Dass going, hey, it's maybe time for you to put together a memoir? I mean, how did that happen? And how long ago was it?
It actually started 10 years ago, or a little more now. Just come to the end of working on Be Loved Now, which came out in 2010. And so we had actually finished the work, I guess, in 2009. I approached him with an idea because we really had a good time working together. That I think was sort of the basis for the whole project and others along the way, which you've worked on also, starting back with Love, Serve, Remember, which is what our foundation is called.
Yeah.
Which Raghu is the executive director of, as well as the chief podcaster.
And chief pottery cleanser. Chief pot cleaning, yes.
Yes, and chief cook and bottle washer is what my mother used to call it.
Yeah.
And when I first approached Ram Dass about doing the memoir, though, he really, he was like, first of all, he didn't want to look at the past particularly. I mean, his thing is be here now, being in the moment, then not living in the past. And the other aspect of it, actually, that he was very reluctant about was he really wanted to be very careful about not hurting anyone's feelings. He was quite emphatic about that. So we talked around it a little bit. And after that first refusal, we came around to the idea that we would look back at his life through Maharaji's eyes and try and not try, but just feel what that would be like seeing from that other consciousness that we all have experienced in, you know, so many dimensions of our lives, even though, you know, we probably have barely an inkling of the vastness of that state. But that is the common thread for so many of us. And Ram Dass finally got used to that idea and he started to like it. So we started going through things and it wasn't particularly a linear exercise, you know, start at the beginning of his life. And as it turned out, we got to the end of his life.
Talk about being in the moment, right?
Yeah. But I think in the process, it was really, you know, fascinating. And I was going back and forth to Maui maybe three times a year. And we were working on Skype together also. And sometimes just on the phone. There were a lot of ups and downs for him, I think, including one episode when we were talking, and it was maybe in about 2010 or maybe 2011, and he was alone in the house, and it was at a point where he still had the strength to transfer himself from his chair to his wheelchair and was pretty mobile still. And we were talking about a passage in a book that we both had, and he transferred to go get his chair and get into his chair and to go get the book so we could discuss it. Whoops, I have to turn something off here, Raghu. I had the news going there.
It's okay. It's all part of podcasting. No problem.
Okay. I think we got
I'm hoping my dog, who's right next to me, doesn't start snoring. Okay.
Yeah. Well, if our dog comes back, which she may, she's going to want dinner. It's dinner time on the East Coast for dogs.
Yes. All right. So continue. Well, so Ram Dass was transferring to his chair.
He was transferring, and I didn't hear anything back from him. And finally, I hear a voice that says, I fell. I'm on the floor. And there was nobody in the house. And I'm in New York and he's in Maui.
Oh, geez.
And what am I going to do? I tried to reach Dasima on the phone. And as it turned out, I mean, this is a whole other story, but there was a young woman who's a devotee, who's a musician. She's a cellist. You probably remember her. Her name is something like Aisha. No, that's not quite it. Anyway, she was nearby and she gets this thought in her mind that she's got to go see Ram Dass. She drives over. She doesn't hear anything. And then she calls out and he responds and she goes up and helps him to get onto the bed. It turns out he broke his hip.
Oh.
And when he fell, getting transferring. And he ended up in the hospital, had a hip replacement, and that was a whole other saga.
Yeah. Mo.
And at another point, I was out there working with him, and I was out walking early in the morning before we had breakfast, and I get a call from my son in New York, and there's sirens in the background, and that was my daughter had been run over on her bike, 14-year-old, and she died. She didn't make it out of the surgery at the trauma hospital. And Ram Dass helped me, I don't want to say cope with it, because there's no way to do that, but it was an intense moment, and it's still ongoing, and that was 7 years ago.
Why don't you mention, though, what he said to you regarding a young person dying?
When we heard that she hadn't made it out of surgery, I looked at him and said, she didn't get to finish her life. And he looked me straight in the eye and he said, yes, she did. And it that view, which we had been looking at his life through that lens of seeing an incarnation, and that took me out of my own pain and self-pity for a moment, enough to see that that was the case with her too. And as you know, as much as I didn't want to accept that, there was no choice.
Yeah.
It was what Trungpa used to call choiceless awareness.
Yeah. Good karmas to be.
It's been a journey.
Yeah. Good karmas, though, to be with Ram Dass in that moment, who had done a tremendous amount of work in this area over his lifetime. That was a big part of his offering, certainly around death and dying. And so to have that right with you in that moment.
And then I was with him when he died.
Yeah, right. That's right. So Ram Dass did pass just after the book was completed, not fully, but mostly. Ramesh happened to be there at that moment with a couple other people.
Yeah, I had stayed to read the updated manuscript to him, and we didn't get much done because he was he had another infection, which I guess is what took him out really finally, he was kind of groggy from antibiotics, and we just hung out. And K.D. Krishnadas was there for the first week or so, and then he had to go, and there were just a few people.
Yeah. Well, what we have today, I'm getting a little lost in the moment, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, but we have here several excerpts that we've gotten that represent different parts of Ram Dass's teachings, life, and his...
These are from his talks, not from the book.
That's right. These are from his talks, but certainly they refer absolutely to what goes on in this book. The book is extremely comprehensive. It is, what, 550 pages or something like that?
Yeah, plus about...
Plus
65
pictures.
Pages of photos.
Yeah. So it is very, very comprehensive. So the first, and we're going to play this, and then we'll just talk about it for a minute. The first one is we are calling Relative Reality. And I'm going to just play this, and then we'll chat.
What happened to me, in brief, from inside myself, was that after I took the psilocybe mushrooms in 1961, my entire understanding of reality changed. And it changed my entire life, and you're paying to hear about it. Isn't that fun? I love it. I love it. Basically, what happened was that I went from seeing a reality that I had been trained to interpret as reality, as absolutely real. I went from that to, in a moment or in the few hours, to moving through planes of consciousness to understand that the reality that I thought was real, like Richard, come down to reality, my father would say, was indeed just one reality. It was relatively real instead of absolutely real. What happened to me was exactly what Einstein did to Newton. Because Newton said, these laws are absolutely real. Mechanistic theory, I remember learning it in high school as absolutely that's the way the world is. And then basically Einstein said, it depends on where you're standing in time and space and so on. Now, I can't overestimate the significance of the shift of consciousness that goes from seeing reality as absolute to seeing it as relative. It opens up a vast terrain of possibilities. It's what William James said when he said, our normal waking consciousness is but one type of consciousness. While all about it, parted from it by the filmiest of screens, there lie other types of consciousness. We may spend our entire lives without knowing of their existence, but apply the requisite stimulus, and there they are in their completeness. Whatever their meaning, they prohibit our premature closing of our accounts with reality. That was uttered by William James. And I was basically thrown out of William James Hall at Harvard for arguing that the intellectual analytic mind was only one plane of reality, because that was heresy within that temple. So opening the doors of that, you see what it did? It cast me out from the dominant theme of our culture, which is basically a form of scientific materialism. Humanism, scientific materialism, right in there. It's rooted in the feeling that technology and science have paid off so much in changing the quality of our lives. And those models, a way of defining reality and how to interpret what's real, have worked so well, we can't really question them. The predicament is they are relatively real, but there are other realities they have nothing to say about. But science really has a hard time accepting there are other realities it can't say anything about. It's like the issue of consciousness versus the brain. Science really has very little to say about consciousness. It's got a lot to say about the brain. So since it's got a lot to say about the brain, what it says then is the brain and consciousness are really one thing, isomorphic. But our technology doesn't allow us to measure it from the point of view of consciousness, so we'll work on the brain. But we know when your brain is dead, you aren't. See? Somebody that has seen relative reality says, like they do in India, when you die in India, they call it dropping the body. Isn't that an interesting image? Well, I'm going to drop my body today. Who's the I that's going to drop what? In the West, that's a very peculiar expression, because when your body isn't, you aren't. So it seems to me that what happened to me in 1961, and that certainly got reconfirmed 1,000 times over when I met Neem Karoli Baba in 1967, was that there was a larger context in which I existed than the one that I thought I did and that everybody around me was telling me I did.
Relative reality. So I mean, I remember just the first talk that I heard from Ram Dass, which is probably a year and a half after you heard the first one, or even more, I can't remember, mm-hmm. but Ramesh was at Ram Dass's first chat. It was more of a chat. It was an 8-hour kind of
an chat. About 70 people.
Relative reality. So obviously the one huge thing in first hearing Ram Dass and his take on reality, basically, through his own experience and everything that happened to him as a psychology professor, as a psychonaut with Leary at Harvard, as a yogi in India. So, and he talks here a lot about the relative levels, right? So, and so that perspective, once it's a huge thing, seeing reality as absolute, which is how we all come into this. Everything we think is as real as it gets. And then seeing it all as relative, it opens up a whole new territory. And this, until that happens, nothing happens. And that may happen. Of course, it happened through psychedelics with Ram Dass. It happened that way for many of us that went over to India. But it can happen in many different ways. Reading a book now, being at a Krishnadas Kirtan, something happens that's ineffable and leads you to believe, wait a minute, there is another territory here. It's the perfect opener for Ram Dass in terms of, I feel, what he offers on an immediate basis is a radical shift of perspective.
And I think that occurred to, that's what shifted for me when I first met him. Mm. But in a sense, these three lives that he had, combined in his incarnation, being a psychologist, the psychedelic work, and becoming a yogi, those three viewpoints all came to bear in the way that he saw that, he talked a lot about planes of consciousness, so that he saw the different ways that the mind is a projector of reality. And that started with psychology. And then when he started working with psychedelics, especially that first time that he took psilocybin, and he saw his various selves as external to his inner being, his roles as opposed to his soul, which is often how he referred to it.
Yeah.
And, in talks, he used to do that thing where he would kind of take you through changing channels. In your mind, visualize your head as a TV screen, and change the channel to the astral plane, the causal plane, the soul, the physical plane.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that was one of the really fundamental parts of his identity also. And so much of his teaching, and as you'll find in the memoir, his journey is about identity.
Yeah. And in this next little excerpt that we're going to play, it is a recounting, brief one, of his first psychedelic experience and which you just referred to, and how that radically, radically changed him, changed every one of us. And it's wonderful to think, actually, Ramesh, of how they're getting so, they legalized psilocybin in Oregon, I believe, for therapeutic purposes. And maybe more than that, I'm not sure, but I know that at least is what's happening. And I think it'll happen more and more because of the work, especially the work of MAPS and Rick Doblin.
Yeah.
Who is very connected to Ram Dass, came later, and he, you know, he's been doing this work, you know, since he was a young man, and it's come to the point where their government is starting to give permission for this to be used in therapy and so on. And it's so powerful a thing.
And there's one part of the book, actually, where Ram Dass mentions Rick doing this study when he was still an undergraduate. Mm. He did a review of the what was called the Good Friday experiment at Harvard.
Yeah, that's right.
And it was really fascinating. And the Good Friday experiment was where they gave psilocybin to divinity students on Good Friday, and they all were down in the crypt under the chapel where this sermon was being given. And it was, you know, the classic double-blind experiment where nobody knew who was getting the psilocybin and the other students, half of them got, I think it was niacin or niacinamide, which gives you a rush, kind of, you know, of that niacin flush.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then it very soon became very obvious who had actually gotten the psilocybin, who hadn't. But yeah. The follow-up study that Rick did demonstrated that 25 years later, the people who had gotten the psilocybin, the divinity students, many of whom had become, you know, priests or works, has stayed in religion in one way or another, that that had been a formative mystical experience in their lives.
Mm. Amazing.
And amazing. I think that his work in MAPS has really, you know, continued from that inspiration in many ways.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's play this excerpt, and you can, it's, we're calling it First Trip, which it is for Ram Dass. Yeah. Here you go.
When I first experimented with these mushrooms, the Tiananactl, these flesh of the gods, which were used in Mexico by curanderos and oracles, in order to override their habitual way of looking at the universe, in order to see things freshly or innocently. Okay, so what the mushrooms did was they overrode my way of conceiving of the world, so I saw things afresh. And what I saw was that I had built this incredible structure of mine called ego about who I thought I was, and little by little it fell away. And my initial experience was so powerful in that sense, because what I met was a part of me inside that had nothing to do with who I thought I was. And it had nothing to do with that which is born or that which dies. It was behind that. It was the first time I had gone behind that. Let me, just the emotional part of it was that I had taken these mushrooms and I sat in a darkened room on a couch, and I suddenly saw a person in the dark over there, and I looked across and there was a being that was me. But it was me in one of my social roles. It was almost a caricature of me. It was me with my pilot helmet on. I never wore a pilot helmet, but I was a pilot. And there was my pilotness. And now it was separate from me. It was about 8 feet away from me. And I thought, all right, I'll let that go. Because I was a psychologist, remember, a professor, and I was saying to myself, interesting hallucination you're having. Okay? It seemed reasonable. I was analyzing it as a scientist. So I let go of that, and then all one by one, all my social roles appeared across the room, of lover, of professor with mortar and, you know, all of that stuff. Each of my roles appeared, and one by one I let it go, until something appeared which was like my childhood identity of myself. And I thought, if I let that go, I will be, I'll have amnesia. I won't know who I am. And that's what this mushroom is going to do to me. I thought, oh, well, I'll let that go too. And so I did. And I thought, at least I have my body. And then I looked down and there was the couch. And I looked from one end of the couch to the other and there was no body on it. Now, my mind can say, as long as I want, hallucination, but what I experienced was fear. Because being a materialist all my life, a philosophical materialist, there was nothing that prepared me with my eyes open to not see my own body. All right? That's like,
your worst dream. You don't exist anymore. And I was about to scream for help when I thought, who's about to scream for help? I mean, if I'm not my personality and I'm not my body, who's frightened? And at one moment, I touched a part of me that had nothing to do with all that. And it was so joyous, so unexpected, because what it felt like was I had come home, something very familiar to me. And it was a way in which I experienced a connection to the universe that I had never understood before. I'd never had it. I was always doing good in order to be appreciated or prove that I was adequate or control this vast situation that was out of control. And I ran out in the snow and I somersaulted and then I went home. It was a big snowstorm. And my parents, I came back to my parents' home and I went to shovel the walk. It was about 4 a.m. and my parents appeared at the upper window looking scoldingly like nobody shovels snow at 4 a.m. And I looked up and I saw these were the people I'd always listened to who always told me what was right and wrong. And I looked inside my heart and it seemed all right to be shoveling snow at 4 a.m. And I waved at them and I threw them a kiss and I went back to shoveling snow. And that, of course, was the beginning of the end of my life in a sense, because I had stood up to an authority that ended up my being thrown out of Harvard.
So, yeah, sitting on the ceiling, looking down and going, whoa, who's that? What's that thing lying on the couch? You know, I love that. It's so archetypical of the power of psychedelics in being able to see you are not that thing. You are not.
Well, I think the central experience of that first trip for him was this feeling of being home. And that was also what he kept trying to come back to all through the time that they were working with psilocybin. I think often felt at least aspects of that, no matter what they were working with. But when he came to Maharaji, that was the dominant feeling that he had. And I know for myself, when I came to Maharaji the first time, which was in 1970, first of all, I realized when I got there that Maharaji had come through Ram Dass when I first met him, because the feeling being with Maharaji was the same as being with Maharaji with Ram Dass that first time. And it was this feeling of being home. And it was just a deep heart space. Hard to describe. I used to have this experience when I was in high school, and I would drive out to see my grandparents. And I had a very close relationship with them, and it was this real feeling of coming back to the kind of experiences of childhood. In a really deep sense of enjoyment. And it was similar to that. And then, of course, it got deeper and deeper.
How about deep okayness?
Yeah.
Very deep okayness. And how is it that every person you'll ever talk to who happened to meet Neem Karoli Baba Maharaji, they say the same thing.
Yeah.
Home. My thing was, my first thought was, oh shit, that's what Ram Dass was all about. Holy shit. You know, and home, you know, and that home, and it's taken us quite some time to understand that it's not outside ourselves. He reflected it in to, so we could see ourselves. And we've done a lot of flopping around trying to look elsewhere, but
half a century later, it's still working on us.
Yeah, Exactly. So, but the idea of home that Ram Dass got with this psychedelic trip is very profound and very much, I don't think there's anybody that I know who's taken a psychedelic, you know, from those days up until like now, where I meet many, many people, next gen, 20s and 30s mm-hmm. and so on. And their description is exactly the same. Yeah. And that home is as profound as any home that we got into at any stage. So that is to me living proof of the reality of that place. It's just, of course, trying to hold on to it doesn't really do it. And as Krishnadas, our buddy, likes to say, practice makes perfect.
Well, it's not called practice for nothing.
That's yeah, right. Exactly. So
I know one of the, there is more psychedelic research happening again now. And I know one of the researchers at NYU in New York.
Yeah.
Where they've done psilocybin research with terminal cancer patients. And they're now undertaking a study with religious leaders, not so different from the Good Friday experiment.
Yeah.
And those same kinds of things are happening, yeah. And it's deeply
experientially.
Profound. It's helping people with their fear of death, very profoundly.
Yeah, exactly.
And Roshi Joan Halifax and her former husband Stan Grof did a lot of work with that, which Ram Dass was very aware of.
Yeah,
at Spring Grove Hospital in Maryland.
Yeah, people came more than once. But once there was a rather substantial group of researchers that came just to reflect on it all with Ram Dass after all those years. But they wouldn't let us record it. Still fear out there. You know. So this next excerpt is basically, of course, this we just talked about it a little bit, but Guru Found is a little name that... let's give credit to Nathan.
Nathan,
who has curated these wonderful pieces, Nathan Wilburn. We've been talking about it, and I also know, and guess this also refers to psychedelics and that experience. Ram Dass would say more than once that he's not sure, he said, I am not sure what it might have been had I meeting a being like Neem Karoli Baba Maharaji without having that psychedelic experience, without having the experience of the relative reality mm-hmm. and home base is kind of what we're talking about. And without that, it would have been difficult. And I see the same thing, for all of us. I mean, we were obviously really young.
A lot of us got there that way.
Yeah, exactly.
That was what propelled many of us. Yeah,
It absolutely helped. So, all right, well, let's listen to this Guru Found.
So we got out of the car at the temple, and Bhagwan Das asked, where's the Guru? And they said, the Guru is up in the hills, up in that hill over there, around the hill. And Bhagwan Das goes off at a lope, but all the way up into the hills, tears are streaming down his cheeks. And I know that we're getting close to something very powerful, but I don't know what it is. And I'm very bugged about the car, and I'm sulking in the corner, and, you know, I've been smoking too much hashish. So I had stopped a few days before, but I was having the down effect one has after having smoked for a long time. We rush up the hill. I'm rushing behind him, trying to keep up with him, and I'm being ignored by everybody, and I'm just in terrible shape, really, stumbling up this path. And we come out into this field, beautiful sunny day, overlooking a valley, and there's an old man sitting there with a blanket wrapped around him. Around him are about, eight or probably eight or ten Hindu people sitting there. And we rush over, and Bhagwan Das does Danda Pranam, the full pranam, out flat on his stomach before this man. and he's crying, and the man's patting him on the head, and it's some kind of joyous reunion, and I'm standing by, you know, what am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to touch this guy's feet, or, you know, I don't know what to do. I've never seen a guru before. And I assumed if he was crying this much, it must be somebody. But I was too angry to even care, to tell you the truth. And after a few minutes, this man looked up, and he looked at me. He smiled, and he said in Hindi to Bhagwan Das, have you a picture of me? Bhagwan Das says, yes. He says, give it to him. Bhagwan Das said, all right, I will. Then he looked at me, he says, you came in a big automobile? I said, yeah. You'll give it to me? Well, that really blew my mind. I mean, you know, I wish I could have, but, you know. So I said, well, it's not mine to, not mine to give, and, you know. Well, you get me one like it? So I thought, my God, I just got here and he's hustling me. I mean, what kind of a thing is this? You know, what have I done to deserve this? Am I that bad a person that I got to be subjected, you know? And I was, boy, was I self-pitying and paranoid. All the time he's laughing. So he's laughing, he's putting me on. But I don't know that. Costs a lot of money, he says. You make a lot of money in the United States? Yeah. So I used to. You'll get me a car like that? It rides nice, huh? It's just coming on to me, something fierce, right? Okay. And I'm really angry, but I'm suppressing it and answering pleasantly, and everybody's smiling at me, and I'm smiling at everybody. Then he says, take them for food. And they take us to a room, and they give us a big feast. These beautiful sadhus bring us food, the food that the women bring to the guru each day as an offering. And we eat, and then a few minutes later, Bhagwan Das and I are together all the time, and he's the only one I've come with. And this is way up in the remote mountains. There's no electricity up here, nothing going, you know, very remote. Call back to the guru and go back to him, and he says to me, he looks directly at me, right in my eyes, and he said, you were out under the stars last night. Acha, you were thinking about your mother. Acha. Leaned back, and then he said, she died last year. He said, she got very big in the stomach before she died. He said, she died of spleen. He didn't ask. He said, she died of spleen. Well, the only way I can describe what experience I had at that moment, and he looked at me with a twinkle at that point. Now, the only way I can describe what happened to me at that moment is to compare my rational mind to a computer that has been fed an insoluble problem. That the computer runs through all of the alternative resolutions of this problem that are in the storage units, and it runs off each of them in sequence. You know, and I thought, well, does he have a telephone? Was Bhagwan Das away from me for a moment? Bhagwan Das doesn't even know my mother's dead. How is he going to? Because he wasn't interested in my past. He doesn't know that. I've never said to, you know, was he reading my mind? Was I thinking about it at this moment? What would that mean? You know, and I went through, but I wasn't even thinking about it. I had even forgotten what she died of. I mean, the spleen, I hadn't even remembered the term of the organ. So the computer went and went and went, and then as computers do, when it finishes its analysis through the storage unit, a little red light goes on and a bell rings and it stops. And that is literally what happened to my rational mind at that point. I realized I'd just been overwhelmed. I mean, I, ego, Richard Alpert, had just been beaten. You know, there was nowhere to hide. I wasn't high, so I couldn't say this was a drug hallucination. There was a guy doing this thing right to me right then, right, through my gross senses. And at that moment, when that computer stopped, it was like a very severe pain in my heart. It was like a really wrenching feeling. And I started to cry. I wasn't crying because I was sad, and I wasn't crying because I was happy. The closest way I could describe it maybe is I was crying because I was home. I mean, because, yeah, right. Whew. Wow. That kind of feeling. Like I didn't have to do it anymore. It all It was all okay.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Stop for a moment and think about something that you really need to get off your chest. It could be frustration with your job or a coworker. It could be fear or uncertainty about the future. It could be a secret that you've been hiding for years. We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. When we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever is weighing you down. Speaking with a therapist on a regular basis is also a great way to improve your communication skills, learn to resolve conflict, increase your self-awareness and self-esteem, develop positive coping strategies, build stronger relationships, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, plus switch therapist at any time for no additional charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/Ramdas today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Ramdas.
So the amazing thing, though, Ramesh, with Ram Dass is throughout his whole life. I mean, the premise of this book is seeing his entire life through the lens of Neem Karoli Baba, through his guru, mm-hmm. through our guru, and being able to see exactly how the family that he was born into, the relationship he had with his mother, with his father, with his siblings, how the school that he went to, the relative level of ease financially the family had, and all of it, how it all played, like just a little thing. I don't know if you ever even talked to him about this, but, you know, the whole thing Maharaji said, don't take an inheritance from your father.
Yeah, he does talk about that.
Yeah. And
how that changed his relationship with his father.
Yeah. But how he grew up, but seeing through that Maharaji's lens, mm-hmm. he grew up where that was what you did. Okay.
Yeah.
You, the affluent family, and you're part of that family, and all of the affluence turns to you and gets, you know, it gets propagated generationally. So he had that in his DNA. So it's not nothing to just, oh yeah, no problem. And of course, Maharaji made him the whole thing, don't carry money, same kind of a deal. The saint doesn't carry mm-hmm. money. So he gets my brother Lakshman to carry his money around and drive him absolutely insane. And then he had to get a succession of people to do that. I'm not carrying money. So he gave all his money, and these people were spending it inordinately where yeah. he never would have spent it. And he, you know, so just... Those are
There are two aspects that came up in the process of the book that I want to flag for that. One, going back to what we were talking about and how psychedelics kind of opened things up to and allowed Maharaji's darshan to penetrate. And then allowed Ram Dass to adapt to being a yogi so completely. And he said that psychedelics, in he said this in the book, that psychedelics allowed him to change planes more easily because he had done so much of that when he was tripping. Hmm. And that facility allowed him to be open to where Maharaji was coming from in ways that he might not have otherwise. And that it was like a kind of a ability to be flexible in his in that view of reality, those relative realities. And then when he met Maharaji, he encountered a different reality, which was you know, so much more powerful being with Maharaji. Mm. And the other thing that we did in the book, which was really interesting, we did sort of a, and it's in the latter part of the book, we've kind of talked about what it may have been like before he took incarnation as Richard Alpert. And what that place is of, you know, what sometimes is described as a bardo, but the in-between incarnations. And, you know, we talk a lot in for instance, in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, they're talking about what the after-death planes are like and what the opportunities for letting go and getting into the clear light at that point. But the part about before you take birth, that was an interesting one. And he talks about what it might have been like getting guidance from a being like Maharaji to look at the incarnation and know that he was going to be, you know, part of the Alpert family and how this was going to help him work out his power and love karma. And then this kind of knowing that Maharaji would come into the picture at a certain point and take over, which is what happened. And then, you know, that thing about taking birth and the veil covers you and you forget all about that. And you only know that you're embodied in, you know, as in his case is Richard Alpert in Newton, Massachusetts.
Yeah. Remembering wouldn't be good.
Maybe not.
No.
Some people do. I suppose Tibetan tulkus, I think, have a certain amount of that. Or
Even then.
Promise, but,
even then. Yeah, that's... that's a profound...
It's an interesting shift, though. It's part of that shift to seeing it, his life as an incarnation, rather than this life, which is what, you know, certainly personally I'm stuck in seeing. I don't see anything beyond it. And Maharaji did, I think. There's that story of Maharaji with walking with one of the devotees, and he—I think it's in that excerpt, actually, or one of the other ones we're going to talk about that near the end. Hmm. So I won't tell the story.
Okay, yeah, let Ram. I do that though when I introduce Ram Dass. I tell what I like, and it's okay. Yeah. You can hear it. It's repeated. It's, you know, these things. We've been listening to Ram Dass forever, and me even more these days because of the work of the foundation. And it there's always something fresh that I didn't really hear before, or that he just made a little bit of a complete fresh perspective on something that he might have been talking about ad infinitum. Mm-hmm. That just does the click because he had that power, you know.
For sure.
Well, let's listen to the next one, which is called The Purpose of Life. All right, let's listen to that.
What's the purpose of our life on earth? It's a curriculum that the soul has created in order to explore its own attachments, in order to awaken out of its illusion of separateness, which it created as part of its play. It's not an error. You didn't fall from grace. It's not original sin. It's choice. I had an interesting discussion with a Tibetan rascal named Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. He once called me into his room. I just met him once, and he called me and he said, Ram Dass, we have to accept responsibility. It's a great opening line, isn't it? I said to him, what responsibility, Rinpoche? I don't have any responsibility. God has all the responsibility. Not my, but thy will, O Lord. Giving him a bhakti dualist, you know. Mm. He said, "You're copping out." And it bugged me because I didn't understand it. What do you mean I was copping out? Then Emmanuel said to me, "You have the choice." He said, "You can be the victim or you can be the creator." And the victim is when you identify with any part of the form of the manifestation. Your body, your personality, your thinking mind, that's all part of lawful unfolding. That's all the victim. There's a part of you that has no form. That part's the creator. It's not the part that makes affirmations. That's your personality. That's all part of what's being had. Personality, body, that's all in law. That's all form. It's all happening. It's all karma unfolding. That part isn't. Even the experience you think you're free isn't free. And yet there is a part of you that is free, that is creating, that could change anything you want in the universe. The only funny part about it is that were you identify with that part of your being so that you were outside of it and seeing all, you'd see why you had created it that way in the first place. It's like in the Bible, it said, "Had ye but faith, ye could move mountains." But if you had the faith, you'd see why you put the mountain there in the first place. So that from the soul's point of view, it's on a journey, a creative journey, and it has created a set of experiences which are selected by your body and your personality. That's the way, the selecting mechanism. That's the programming that's gone into it, to the experiences you're going to have. And you keep going through them until you are so clear that even at the moment of death, instead of "I'm dying," or even "here I go," it's just another moment. Nothing special. Nothing special. To go into the white light of death means that you're already about 3/4 of the way turned around while you're still alive. There's nowhere to stand. The third Chinese patriarch, "The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. But make the slightest distinction and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart."
The purpose of life. So to me, this is the other, not the other, another very, very important part of what Ram Dass's legacy is. And that's around it gives us the ability to lay back and relax. Okay, and he talks about it's a curriculum, right? And the soul has created this curriculum in order to awaken out of the illusion and of separateness. And that's the key. And at the same time, what Ram Dass has added into this, and this is so well reflected throughout the book, that very, very, thank God he did it, humor. Okay. Not taking oneself so self-seriously and creating the kind of space around our day-to-day entrapment in our minds and our stories and our thoughts and so on. And having the perspective of this being a curriculum, and I think that came from Emmanuel, who his spook friend, he calls it.
Yeah.
Ram Dass, it's a curriculum. Take it.
Well, I think that was also what he brought back from his yoga training in India. And, you know, Hari Das used to tell him things like, desire is the creator, desire is the sustainer, desire is the destroyer. Desire is Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, it's the creation. And that that's part of that same thing of seeing reality as a projection of our desires. And the piece that he quotes from the third Chinese patriarch at the end of this excerpt from the about the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. And there was that great, I mean, back when we did Love, Serve, Remember, that record set, yeah. And that was the first reading he had done. Recorded that piece, The Third Chinese Patriarch. And
worth getting, everybody. It's fantastic. We should, in fact, we should make them up and give them away. I know you've done it in the past. You've made them little booklets up or somehow. I don't know if you have any more.
No, they're about gone.
Well, we're going to do something. Okay, whoever's listening out there,
It's a download now, right?
It's a download, but it's nice that Ram Dass created these beautiful little booklets of with the entire poem. And it's so great. Yes.
But that is what Maharaji, I think, you know, partly through Haridas and partly through the yoga training. That and all of our Buddhist training when we studied with Goenka also.
Yeah.
That was the using the that witnessing to see how your mind creates your reality.
Yeah.
And that, I think his ability to bring his psychology training, the work that he'd done with psychedelics and his yoga training all to bear in teaching about that was really great. And with that incredible humor.
Yeah, yeah.
Of not taking it all too seriously. And we, you know, we're certainly all guilty of climbing into our righteousness about who we think we are.
Yeah.
And then exactly. How it should all be.
Yeah. But just the idea that you can just shift that perspective. You know, his later years and in Maui was all around shifting to loving awareness out of your head. The idea that it can happen and the idea that you're going to get lost over and over again. But there is always the coming back. We love Sharon Salzberg, our close friend, who in every meditation, it's okay. You get lost, you can come back. And here, and Ram Dass offers this, the idea of, it's a curriculum, see? That means like stuff that happens sometimes, not so fun, but it is part of the burning off of whatever needs to be burned off so that more spaciousness and freedom can occur. So, yeah, I think that's really, goes along with the perspective of knowing, okay, I'm stuck in that thing that I think I am, and it goes along, you know. So it's quite an evolvement.
Yeah, I love
what
that,
he represents.
You know, that literal translation of nirvana or nibbana as burned out.
Yeah.
That stuff gets burned out finally. Yeah. And, you know, it is, again, practice that carries you slowly, as KD says, slowly but inevitably. Yeah. And I love his analogy of, you know, you get on the train of, in his case, chanting, getting into the kirtan and the mantra, the names. And analogy of you get on the train, and even though you're running in the opposite direction that the train is going, the train is still going to the station.
Yeah.
And you're on it.
Yeah. So be happy. There is a curriculum. We are taking it, and it's just a matter of allowing it to be, which is not easy because the vicissitudes. Look where we are now in a pandemic and a whole switch of government and all the kind of racial
justice. Talk about relative realities.
Yeah. I mean, it's easy. And that doesn't mean that you get into home base and go, I'm home, screw it all. Because there's only home for everybody. If everybody's not home, there's no home. You know, so, and that Ram Dass represents in spades, his work in social action, his work with many different foundations, including SEVA, curing blindness in the world, and work with death and dying. And that's where the final piece that we're going to play, which I think is excerpt, is appropriate. It's called Hold On Tightly, Let Go Lightly. And it's around death, but there's some other anecdotes that are really cool in this. And yeah, let's go ahead and play this track.
Now, perhaps the biggest fear of aging is the fear of death. And as long as you are identified with your separateness and you think that's what you are, you will have fear. And if you cultivate the part of you that is not identified with your separateness, you will have a place in you that is not afraid, as well as the place in you that is afraid. You'll have a balancing of those things. And you might even get light enough. A Zen monk is dying, and he hasn't written his death poem. Zen monks are supposed to write death poems. And his students say to him, "Master, you haven't written your death poem yet." And he says, "Oh, I haven't written my death poem." And he grabs the brush and he calligraphies madly and he dies. And it says, "Birth is thus, death is thus, verse or no verse, what's the fuss?" Now, my guru helped change my feelings about it. I mean, I had had many experiences of what are called out-of-body experiences, so I had a sense that I wasn't this body anyway. But my guru was walking with one of his old devotees, and my guru started to laugh, and the old devotee said, "What are you laughing about?" He says, "Well, so-and-so, this old woman devotee, just died." And the friend said, "What are you laughing about? What are you, some kind of a butcher?" And Maharaji said to him, "What would you like me to do, make believe I'm one of the puppets? Would you like me to make believe it's all that real?" Now, the question is, where does somebody go? What happens? It's a mystery. When I sit with that mystery, all the experiences I've had, I don't even have a flicker of anything other than an appreciation that when we drop our body, we just drop our body. Ramana Maharshi's dying, and the people say, "Don't leave, don't leave." And he says, "Don't be silly. Where could I go? It's like I'm just selling the Ford. I'm not going anywhere, you know. No, don't leave us. Don't leave us." It's just a shift of form. And if you have loved somebody in the love that transcends form, even for a moment, you and they aren't going anywhere. Your mind may say they've gone, but that's your mind. The minute you quiet down, go back into your heart, they're right there again. And love really does transcend death. There's not even a doubt in my mind about it. And you remember when I said to Emmanuel, my spook friend, "Emmanuel, what shall I tell people about dying?" He said, "Tell them it's absolutely safe." He said, "It's like taking off a tight shoe." See, that's the world I live in. So when I have a sense of who we are that is so much more vast, Buddha said, "Do you know how many times you have taken birth like this?" He said, "Imagine a mountain 6 miles long, 6 miles wide, and 6 miles high. And every 100 years, a bird flies over the mountain with a silk scarf in its beak. And it runs the scarf across the mountain once every 100 years. In the length of time it would take the scarf to wear away the mountain. That's how long you've been doing this." Sure gives you a different perspective, doesn't it? About time and the meaning of a life. Can you see a life as so precious and beautiful and still learn how to hold on tightly, let go lightly? How to not cling to it? How to be open to the mystery and open to the next part of it by saying, "Okay, and now this, and now this." In the Tibetan tradition, when you're dying, you are trained to stay in the moment. Instead of the model, "I am dying," you are just in the moment. the earth element leaves, you notice heaviness. The water element leaves, you notice dryness. The fire element leaves, you notice coldness. The air element leaves, you notice the out-breath is longer than the in-breath. Just moment, moment, moment. Now this, now this, now this. I have been sitting now with dying people for 10, 15 years, I guess. And I can tell you that it is the richest experience of my life. It is such incredible grace. The two things that awaken the same feelings in me are being present at a birth and being present at a death. And at that moment of death, when you feel the awareness leave the body, and when that person's connection to that which is beyond their body is deep enough because they have relaxed the mind that keeps grabbing at their separateness so that they can just let go very gently. There's not even a ripping. There's not a pushing. There's not a grabbing. The whole secret is to live this moment fully. Now this moment. Now this moment. So if you're in this one, how do you know? The next one may be the one you die in. The best preparation for your dying is that you live this moment now, fully, moment by moment. And then one of them will be the one in which you drop your body. And it'll just be another moment, nothing special. It's not really that dramatic. We milk it so much. Such a big drama. Will he die? Won't he die? Should she die? Sure, we're all going to die. I want to tell you a secret. You're all going to die. But though you perish, you will not die. The whole secret is of extricating yourself from identification with form, because all form corrupts. It all dies. You take care of it, you honor it, you clean it up, you keep it healthy, as it is slowly corrupting. Hold on tightly, let go lightly.
So in the movie Ramesh, Becoming Nobody, the end of that film that we did with Ram Dass that came out at the end of last year, many, many people experience that part, which is all around death and dying, as a profound part of this film. And it is a profound part of Ram Dass's legacy. For sure. I mean, it's stuff he's been working on since the early 70s. It was a through line, you know, through his whole mm-hmm. life. He was an example of dealing with really, you know, through the stroke of really, really tough stuff. I mean, if you tell that story, well, there he is on the floor with a broken hip and nobody in the house. And, you know, he went through tons of stuff like that. By the way...
It's the stroke in particular, yeah. You know, that was that one where he was being brought into the hospital and he's looking up at the pipes on the ceiling and he's realizing he's not thinking about God and he's flunked the test.
And where was Maharaji? You out to lunch? What the hell is going on? God. In terms of the power of that message in that film and how it was, you know, very much a through line for him, how do you feel about how you represented that in the book, which is certainly substantial? His relationship with...
Well, he talks about his work with people, starting with when his mother died, which was, I think, the point where he really realized that the culture and the cultural systems around death were broken. And there was so much denial that his mother was actually dying until he had this one breakthrough conversation with her when... he had stopped in at the hospital where she was kind of going downhill. And all of her doctors and even the rabbi were telling her, oh, you're getting better. You're going to be out of here in a week. And then they'd go outside the room and say, you know, she'll be dead in a week. And so Ram Dass was very hurt by that level of denial, and he felt like he really wanted to change things after that. Mm. And he started working with Stephen Levine and then Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who was the founder of the hospice movement, and Ramdev Borglum, Dale Borglum, who's still running the Living Dying Project in Marin,
yeah,
which is home care, home hospice care for people, but within in a spiritual context, much more than the physical, you know, taking care. And Ram Dass sat bedside with many, many AIDS patients in the 80s. When that was such a prevalent scourge, and kind of glad he missed this one, the pandemic.
Yeah, say at least.
Yeah, but I think for one thing, it loosened his fear of death. I have never known anyone who had less fear of death. And what he says in that excerpt of his spook friend Emmanuel says about death is absolutely safe.
Yeah, I always loved that.
He felt that way.
Yeah.
And yet being with him when he died, you know, it was the first time I'd been with somebody when they left their body. But, you know, I'm not even sure it was a moment. It was more like a process. Hmm. And, you know, the profound thing for me was that I kept feeling him. You know, I mean, he was clearly not in his body. And I think he had left his body before his body even stopped completely. You know, there was sort of, his body was sort of had this reflex gasping for breath still at the end a couple of times. And I think he was gone before that.
Hmm. Wow.
We kept the body at the house, which was his wish, for 3 days after he had died. And people were meditating in his room, and his body was covered with flowers on dry ice. And it was very powerful. Hmm. And that statement about, you know, that... consciousness doesn't cease and love doesn't cease when the body goes. That is a very powerful statement for all of us to consider.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah. It's the mystery for us in the body and on this plane. We don't know. When my daughter died, that was the dominant feeling for me, is I don't know why this happened. I don't know what it means. I don't know where she is. I don't understand. And I still feel that way. But there is that sense that it goes on. And that this profound feeling that we are more part of a cycle, a continuum. And
yeah.
I think that was a great... contribution to people and you know, all of us to work on our own fear of death.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think it's in the movie Becoming Nobody, but he's asked mm-hmm. by Jamie, are you looking forward to your death? He goes, I'm not looking forward to my death. I'm looking forward to what happens after. So he was real with this. It wasn't, there was no bullshit. I mean, you and I sat with him. One of the times that I sat with you while you were doing work on the book, just hanging out, you know,
yeah.
just hanging out. It was around death. That was that particular conversation was around death. He was so transparent and honest, and there just was no bullshit. He was human relative to, you know, I'm not looking towards fun dying. Are you crazy? You know, there was no intellectual up level he was going to go, although it is interesting. I wonder what happens after, you know, those bardos they talk about and all of that. Mm. So, that's one of the first things when he first went to Maui. I don't know if you remember this, when he started living in Maui, I did a thing with, David Silver, our good friend, did an interview with Ram Dass around...
Yeah. I do remember that.
Honesty. Mm-hmm. Being honest with yourself. It was so... And we've never done anything with it, by the way. I looked at it the other day. I'm going to go run by it. But we are so challenged in that way, because we are so stuck in what we think, you know, who we think we are, and so it's Ram to all the identity stuff and the stories we tell ourselves.
Yeah.
And it's so difficult. And of course, psychedelics help with all of that. But I really believe Ram Dass's accessibility in that way, where he was really honest with himself. So we, that was when we first met him. It became easier. Okay, it's okay. We're human. We can, you know, we don't have to act like this curriculum isn't real. And so that, to me, that's one of the most profound parts.
Well, helping people to, you know, deal with their own impending death, which we are all doing in some way or other. I mean, in that excerpt, I think he is talking to people and he says, you know, flat out, well, we're all going to die, right? Mm. And, you know, there's not too much doubt about that.
Well.
And dealing with the fears and feelings and the cultural you know, kind of conditions around that. That's been really a pretty big contribution to helping people out.
And, yeah, big time.
You know, the psychedelic work with death has been a great part of that too.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, if nothing else came out of his teaching, helping people face death was a pretty great contribution.
Yeah.
And it's on so many levels because of the different kinds of work he did. I remember they, when they set up the dying house in Santa Fe, and people with terminal illnesses were coming there to try and to have conscious death. And it didn't work, because the staff and the people like Ramdev, who were running the house and were taking such beautiful care and were so inspiring and loving to people, that they didn't want to leave.
It's funny. Not funny, but poignant. Poignant attachment, grasping. Yeah, it's all right, so down to the
Ramdev
last.
Does it in people's houses.
Yeah, you know, right.
They're not running their own.
That's great. Oh boy, oh boy. Well, we're at the end of our time here. Everybody, of course, being Ram Dass is...
We may be at the end of our own time.
Well, okay. Well, you never know. Being Ram Dass is available everywhere, okay? So it's a fantastic book, and for those of you who have known Ram Dass and have followed him over the years, it's, of course, essential. And for those of you who maybe don't know that much about him, it's this is a great way to learn about a great soul. And
I hope Ram Dass, it's going to be kind of a parable for, you know, people in these times. You know,
yeah.
His life is really kind of an example of how you can work on yourself.
It's an example of somebody who gives a shit about other people and not just themselves. Okay, yeah. I hate to put it as crudely as that, But it is so real. I mean, look at all those years we spent with him in Maui when he was in, I mean, just broken hip strokes. I mean, in and out of hospitals, just a lot of pain, and he never succumbed to it. Ever.
He never complained either, which was pretty remarkable.
Yeah, no, he used to say to me on the phone, I mean, because I talked to him all the time, I'd say, how you doing? Oh, no, just wonderful, he'd go. I went, you are lying to me because I happen to know that you've got a blah, blah. Yeah, well, you know, a little pain and suffering, you know. But someone who just really cared for really loved everyone. Ram Dass,
I think he stayed around quite a lot longer. To
yeah, just and he said,
out.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. No, absolutely. So, Ramesh, who without you, this book would not have been written because Ram Dass was not writing anymore. He had not that ability. So they sat and Ramesh recorded over 10 years. It seems like a long time, but I guess it's real, huh?
Yeah.
10 years. And put that together. Yeoman's effort. Really, everybody owes
great
you a
joy.
A debt of thanks, really.
Yeah.
So thank you for this. And everybody, please.
Thank you for this conversation.
You're welcome. I'm enjoying. This is Ram Dass Here and Now, and that's the beauty, is as Ramesh indicated, there is only love, and it is available every second, every moment, and that includes Ram Dass's soul, which is with us. But we will be back with Ram Dass Here and Now next time. And meanwhile, go to BeHereNowNetwork.com. So many great people and teachers and friends of Ramesh and mine who are doing wonderful podcasts, and we add people all the time, and turning into 2021, we're going to have some pretty fun surprises and new people that we're going to hang out with. So we shall see you next time. Ram Ram.
Ram Ram.
This podcast is brought to you by the Love Serve Remember Foundation and ramdass.org. We appreciate you listening, and we appreciate all the support that you've given us. Please continue that support and donate at ramdass.org. We can then continue to share what Ram Dass has been sharing for all of these years. Thank you.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What do you need to get off your chest? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. When we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, develop positive coping skills, and much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Ram Dass today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/Ram Dass.